You're listening to an American Free Press podcast. Hello and welcome. My guest today is United States Congressman from the 3rd District of Washington, which is tucked away in the southwest corner of the Evergreen State. Brian Baird has served in Congress since 1999, and prior to that was chairman of the Department of Psychology at Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington. He is also a licensed clinical psychologist, graduating Phi Beta Kappa with a BS from the University of Utah and an MS and PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Wyoming. He's also the author of 2 books, among his many other accomplishments, and perhaps most importantly, a parent, along with his wife Rachel, of 2 twin boys, William and Walter. Congressman Baird flies home nearly every weekend, and he's held over 300 town hall meetings. He sits on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, the Science Committee, the Budget Committee, and the House Select Committee on the Continuity in Government. In December of last year, he announced he would not run for re-election. Congressman Baird, Dr. Baird, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
A lot of folks were surprised about you announcing that you would not run for re-election. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, as you mentioned, I have 2 5-year-old boys, and my district's clear across the country. And I wanted to spend more time with family. You know, it seems cliche. And most often, everyone assumes it's a cover for something. And in our case, it's actually sincere. I have these beautiful boys. My wife and I want to do more time with them outdoors, especially in the Northwest. And you know, last fall, August, I looked at how much time I'm spending with them mountains, and it came out to about less than 2% of my time is spent with my kids in the mountains, and I would rather have that be about 20%.
Absolutely. I have 3 boys myself, so I know exactly what you're saying.
Exactly.
And you're an author of actually a book called Are We Having Fun Yet? Is that right?
Right. Regrettably, it's out of print now, but it was designed specifically to combine my love for the outdoors with my clinical psychology background to help families and couples particularly figure out how they can have fun instead of have a miserable time. So often you see people skiing or bicycling or canoeing or something, and they ought to be enjoying themselves and each other and the outdoors, and instead they're bickering with one another. And I thought, that's a real tragedy, so let's try to sort that out.
Absolutely. But you could still get it on, I'm looking at it right now, on Amazon.com. Are We Having Fun Yet? Enjoying the Outdoors with Partners, Families, and Groups, and it's in paperback.
A lot of fun to do.
That's great. And of course, not very many congresspeople come to the institution with your credentials. I think only 24 members of the 111th Congress are healthcare professionals, and you're the only psychologist. Is that right?
There's actually one other, Judy Chu, who was elected in a special election midterm. And then Tim Murphy is a clinical psychologist on the Republican side. So we actually now have 3.
3? Wow. So you were alone for a while, though.
Right. Yeah.
All right. And 23 representatives, but no senators have a PhD. Is that number accurate, you think? Or?
I don't know about
that.
That's a very interesting question.
Yes, I saw that on Wikipedia. And I have to say, from studying you a bit over the past month or so, that with your credentials, with everything you bring to the institution, it will be a lesser institution without your talent, abilities, and perhaps most importantly, your compassion, which was displayed clearly when you took, what was it, 3 trips out to the occupied Gaza Strip?
Indeed, and a number of other, on those trips, we also, and many of them went to, I think on all 3 of those, we also went to the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and on other trips I've gone there as well.
Well, that must have been something else, huh?
It really was. My colleague Keith Ellison and I were the first Americans into Gaza, the first officials. They're really courageous, heroic Americans there every day working for the UN Relief Agency, Mercy Corps, and other relief groups. World Vision has had people on the ground. So those folks really deserve the credit. They're there on a daily basis. But as far as officials, either from administration or Congress, Keith and I were the first Americans in, and we were in, I think, just about 3 weeks after the shelling stopped, and it was pretty raw. The destruction was very fresh and recent, and you could see on people's faces the devastation. I've worked with veterans and been to combat zones on a number of occasions, and there was that look of sometimes called the 1,000-mile stare as people try to recover from the extraordinary bombardment and the loss of 1,000 lives, destruction of schools, hospitals, etc.
You have on your website, of course, at house.gov, where you can access baird.house.gov, your experiences, and there are videos and photos of it. Have you ever seen anything like that in your life?
Well, I have in parts of Iraq where the fighting had been very, very heavy. I had seen images similar to that and to some degree in Afghanistan as well. But, you know, here was a civilian population. You know, we visited, and I really encourage people to log on to the website. There are discussions with hospital administrators and U.S.-trained business people whose businesses were completely destroyed after the area was secured. There are mental health professionals who talk about the challenge of young children being raised in an environment where they're subject to bombardment, where their parents are basically rendered impotent to help protect them, and what that does psychologically. And then, of course, there's a very moving interview with the principal of the American International School of Gaza, which was destroyed by Israeli airplanes and at the loss of the caretaker, but also the loss of the dreams of many, many young people who are actually getting a progressive Western education there. And complete and utter devastation of the school was really extraordinary.
It's quite ironic that many of the weapons that were used on these poor civilians were U.S. weapons paid for by U.S. taxpayers because of the special relationship, quote-unquote, that Israel has with the United States, or at least the leadership of the United States, and that the U.S. will pay a lot of the money to rebuild Gaza. The whole thing just seems upside down, doesn't it?
Well, it does in many, many ways. And, you know, I consider myself a friend of Israel, but I think Israel's policies in Gaza and in the West Bank and East Jerusalem are counterproductive. I think they're inconsistent with core U.S. values of justice and liberty and freedom of movement. And I don't think in the long run they're in the best interest of Israelis. You know, 600,000 people in Gaza are under the age of 14. To somehow punish them on the premise that they elected Hamas is ludicrous. They couldn't vote. Many of them weren't born when the election happened. And when you create conditions of despair, you know, one of the tendencies of people is to say, well, we have to solve this problem or these people will become terrorists and attack us. For me, it's much more fundamental. It's we have to solve this because these people deserve better. They're innocent young people and doctors and nurses and teachers and professionals and business people who would like to live a normal life with all the hopes and dreams of everybody else, but they're effectively living in imprisoned conditions through no fault of their own, none whatsoever, and collective punishment is being imposed upon them. And they're basically helpless to stop it. And we should not support that by anyone, most especially our allies, who use our own money from the U.S. taxpayer to impose that,
right,
and weapons made in the U.S. and sold to them or given to them by the U.S. to carry out the bombings. It is a very, very troubling policy in and of itself and is, in the long run and in the near term, counter to U.S. security interests, which should be our priority as members of Congress, but frankly, it's also counter to Israel's security.
Absolutely. And of course, I think less than 10 House members in total have ever been to Gaza. So it doesn't seem like there's much of an interest. And, of course, many folks will say that AIPAC is to blame, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. They have so much strength in Congress that it's virtually impossible for any of you folks to do anything substantial. What do you think of that?
Well, there are multiple challenges. First of all, many members have many things to do, and one of the challenges is logistical. It's not easy to get to Gaza. The Israelis increasingly are shutting down efforts by not only U.S. members of Congress, but other nations, EU members, and other delegates to get in through the Eretz crossing. Our most recent trip, my own recent trip, and Keith Ellison's as well, we went through Rafah, through the Egyptian side. Well, that's about a 5.5-hour drive from Cairo, and so logistically it becomes much more difficult. There is a political challenge, and merely going there can be perceived to be somehow a sign that someone is
not loyal to Israel enough.
Well, that's basically it, and what the loyalty, in my judgment, should be, first of all, loyalty to the United States of America and its core values. And we shouldn't necessarily worry about whether another country or a lobbying group that supports that country would criticize us for actually trying to find out firsthand on the ground what was done with our money and our weapons.
Do they have too much power?
Well, I think in general in our political system, I have a concern when people, you know, George Washington in his farewell address spoke eloquently and at length about this broad issue. In general, if there's a group that is lobbying our government and our elected officials in the interest of another nation, that's a problem. Whether that other nation is Israel or any other country, that's a problem because our priority ought to be the United States of America. And especially then, if campaign contributions and other things are tied to policies that may actually be not in the long-term best interest of our own country, then I have a problem with that. And there are other regions and other conflict where this same pattern occurs. But as I think is well known, in this particular region, there is a real concern, I think, among many members of Congress about how a visit to that region or a speech would be perceived. You know, the height of that, to me, came during the resolution criticizing the Goldstone report, which investigated human rights abuses.
And you read that whole report.
I read the whole report, and I had been to Gaza, I think, at that point twice, and one of the things that troubled me was member of Congress after member of Congress after member of Congress went to the floor of the House to condemn a report that I had no doubt they had never read about a place they had never been, and none of them had taken the time, none of those who actually spoke out against the report, the Goldstone report, and in favor of the resolution that called for blocking any consideration of it, none of them had taken the time to talk with those of us who'd actually been there. You know, if you're going to speak out against a report, you might at least want to read it.
That would make sense.
And you might want to find out from people who've actually been to the place the report talks about what they had seen, but people didn't. And that was very, very troubling.
And is that illustrative of AIPAC strength, you think?
AIPAC supported the resolution that criticized the Goldstone report. That was a very strong position of theirs. And, you know, whether people did it because of AIPAC support or not, I don't know. But there was certainly AIPAC came out against that report. And, you know, in full disclosure, I've received AIPAC contributions. I have many, many friends who are participants in AIPAC, and I'm grateful for the contributions. But I do think that it was a mistake. The resolution criticizing the Goldstone report was a mistake. I think the bombing of Gaza described in the Goldstone report was very problematic from a justice perspective, as was the rocketing of Sderot that had been going on. I visited, just so people know, I visited Sderot on two different occasions and have great sympathy for the people of Sderot. It is not acceptable to rocket them, but there were alternatives to the devastation that was applied in Gaza, and there had been a ceasefire in place for the better part of 6 months prior to the bombing from Kashled. So there are options, and the conditions right now are not acceptable.
You came into the House in 99, right?
Indeed.
Did you take AIPAC contributions from the beginning?
AIPAC is not an organization. It's not a PAC. It's not a political action committee. But people who are involved in AIPAC make political contributions, and I did. And I still have, like I say, many friends. I hope they're still my friends. And I respect some of what AIPAC does to a great degree. I think it's important to learn about what's happening in Israel. But at the same time, I think there has to be a willingness to say that doesn't mean that we endorse every policy of Israel, particularly if those are contrary to the U.S. national interests and U.S. national positions and values. You know, I have a real problem with that.
Sure, but when someone such as yourself and your colleague, Keith Ellison from Minnesota, stands up, there aren't very many other people standing up. But if it wasn't for you guys, these latest trips, probably be silence coming from the
Well, there might be, but let me just say a few positive things on that. First of all, you know, Keith and I were the first in. John Kerry came in actually the same day, and it was to his great credit. He came with his wife, Teresa. They saw some of the areas, same areas. They were there a bit shorter time, but the fact they were there, I thought, was powerful.
Yes.
Following that, other members went in, and so we sort of broke the dam almost, as it were, and we've had, I think, somewhere around 12 or 15 members, given that there had been about a four-year hiatus with nobody in there, and given the potential personal risk and political risk, that says a lot. And then keep in mind that we had, I think, 54, somewhere in that number, people who either voted no or present when the Goldstone criticizing, when the resolution condemning the Goldstone report came to the floor. That is a new high for any opposition to such a measure. And I think many, many members of Congress are saying, we've got to look at this with greater clarity and objectivity, and with a more critical eye, because U.S. national security interest and U.S. values, and by the way, it's not just national security interest in terms of what's happening vis-a-vis the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Right.
This extends far beyond. I was in the Swat Valley of Pakistan, an area where insurgents crossing the borders, the Taliban are really raising hell with our soldiers and killing them. And we were talking to people about the need for Pakistani support of U.S. efforts to fight the extremist wings of Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And we were at a sort of a town hall meeting with village elders, and this elder said to me, you know, why should we help you guys? And basically, this was translated, but paraphrasing essentially is, why should we help you? We see on the TV what you let happen in Palestine,
right,
and how you treat Muslims in Palestine. Why should we help you in this fight? Well, when people there, and I've heard that throughout the region, any nation in the Arab world, everywhere you go, there is profound concern about what's happening in Palestine, East Jerusalem, West Bank, and Gaza. And on top of that, I think that this is strengthening the hand of Iran. I talked to many, many members of the Arab world, and this includes not only Muslim members, but people of Christian faith who are Palestinians and Christians in other Arab nations. And they say, look, we don't have any great love for Iran, but the Iranians are supporting people who are fighting the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and we support that. Now, if we could take that card off the table, it would help our national security and help our strategic interests, and it would help the people of Palestine who are suffering, I think, great injustice on a daily basis.
But the United States, which is the strongest power in the world, seems not to have the ability to convince Israel to do that.
Well, you know, President Obama, when he made a speech in Cairo, was greeted with great support. Actually, when Keith and I were in Gaza, we met people who had named their kids Barack Obama. Here's an area that had just been bombed, and they were still naming their children Barack Obama. There was great hope. That hope has diminished, sadly, frankly, in response to the fact that the U.S. called, rightfully, in my judgment, for a cessation of settlement expansion. And by the way, that wasn't just President Obama. President Bush had talked about that. President Bush's father had talked about it. President Clinton. This goes way back to Oslo. And when President Obama called for it, people had hope. And then the first thing the Israeli government did was poke them in the eye. And then even when Vice President Biden was in the region, they announced 1,600 more developments in East Jerusalem.
Sure.
And that blatant, overt insult to our country, even as everyone in the world knows we give billions of dollars of military aid to Israel, raised real questions. And I think President Obama was right, is right. The concerns about security interests in the region have been mentioned by such people as James Baker, as David Petraeus. I think they're right. And sadly, some of my colleagues in Congress, I think, have sought to weaken the president's hand in this effort.
Most of your colleagues in Congress.
Well, I think certainly the Republicans have been demagoguing this issue to a great degree, hoping to drive a wedge between Jewish American voters and the Democratic Party.
Right.
What I hope people will understand is if they could go to the region, let's assume you're a strong supporter of Israel, as I am, go to the region and see the things I have seen, I think you would say, as a strong supporter of Israel, I don't think the Israeli policies make sense. I think they're going to jeopardize the long-term security of Israel. They're going to turn it either, and this is not Congressman Brian Baird saying it, this is Ehud Barak saying it.
Sure.
You're either going to have an apartheid state or a democratic state, but if it's a democratic state, just demographics are going to change the fundamental nature of the state of Israel. So their policies are jeopardizing the long-term strategic interests of the United States. They're undermining the cause of justice, and they're weakening Israeli security. Now, it's ironic that in our country, one who's elected to be the United States representative is somehow subject to a loyalty test about where they stand on Israel. And it is supremely ironic that that loyalty test involves supporting policies that, at least in my judgment and many others, are contrary to not only the strategic security of Israel, but its nature as a democratic, progressive state that believes in the rule of law.
Right. As you said, demographics is really, I think, the whole key to this, because the fertility rate of the Palestinians far surpasses that of the Israelis. So.
Well, it's a key, but it's also, I mean, remember too that this transcends Palestine and it transcends Israel. And as the rest of the world looks at this, they look at it through the lens of justice. And they say, you know, the Arab Peace Initiative, which many people don't know about, but the Arab Peace Initiative, supported by the Arab League and the Conference of Islamic States, has said Arab nations are fully willing to recognize Israel with full diplomatic relations, with guarantees of existential security, with economic relationships, etc., if certain conditions are met, and the conditions are not unreasonable. Independent Palestinian state, 67 borders or something approximating that,
right,
and shared capital of Jerusalem. So there's a myth out there that the entire Arab and Islamic world has called for the destruction of Israel. That is not true. It is not true at all. And importantly, there is a risk that if some progress is not made, the potential offer of the Arab Peace Initiative is going to be withdrawn or weakened, and that leads to much greater tension and much greater insecurity for Israel and for our own people and interests in that region.
President Eisenhower, of course, warned on his farewell address about the military-industrial complex. Do you have any warnings for people coming into Congress, since you'll be leaving shortly, about Israel?
what I wish is that all of my colleagues, you know, we went there. There are groups within Israel, first of all. There are many Israeli human rights groups. I've met with Israeli journalists, former Israeli generals, Israeli politicians, Israeli peace activists, existing members of the Knesset, who say this policy of our country is not in our own country, meaning their country, Israel, their own country's national interest. It is
right.
Contrary. So it's not, ironically, there is often more freedom of speech in Israel.
Yes.
Than there seems to be in the United States Congress and U.S. political discourse. But people need first to understand that what they may hear from some groups here stateside about what is in the interest of Israel and what is in the interest of the U.S. may not actually comport with the facts on the ground. They need to explore that. And secondly, they need to travel to Israel for certain, hear the Israeli side of it, which I have done now on several occasions, but they also then need to go to places like Bethlehem, like Gaza, like parts of the West Bank, like East Jerusalem. Let me give you one example from East Jerusalem.
Sure, please.
Hospital. Augusta Victoria and Hospital is the leading cancer hospital for Palestinians. As we speak, there are children there who have serious brain tumors, most likely not only life-threatening, but tragically, ultimately life-ending.
Oh, jeez.
Their parents cannot be with them because Israeli IDF policies, Israeli Defense Force policies, will not let the parents come from Gaza to be with their children in the cancer hospital. Now, not that the parents have any record at all of any political involvement with Hamas or any terrorist activity at all. They are just of a certain age.
That's horrible.
Well, it is, and yet that is happening as we speak. There are children in the hospital, in Augusta Victoria Hospital, a cancer hospital, that cannot have their parents by their bedside because the IDF won't let them out.
That must be killing the parents.
As the father of 2 5-year-old boys, people sometimes say, well, how do you care about this so much? You know, during Cast Lead, there was an international photo of 3 little Palestinian children, and I showed the photo on the floor of the House during the Goldstone debate.
Right.
And I said, you know, these could be our kids. And they looked for all the world like they were sleeping. They looked almost exactly the age of my boys were at the time.
Right.
And they looked like they were sleeping, except in the picture, sort of in the corner, was a father with his hands over his head. And you could just tell these were his kids, and they'd been killed.
They were dead.
And they were dead. And that has to stop. And whether it's Hamas rockets coming into Sderot and driving those kids to bomb shelters or the Israeli bombardment of Gaza, we've got to stop that. And there are too many people who are turning a blind eye to that suffering. And it cannot continue. It just must not. If you ask yourself, I would ask my colleagues in Congress.
Yes.
You tell me how you would feel if your child, the person you love most in the whole world, got a diagnosis of brain cancer. And then you were told, and your child can go to the hospital, but you cannot go with them. And if they die, which they very likely are going to, you will not be by their side to hug them when they die. And our ally is doing that as we speak, and many of my colleagues are turning a blind eye to that, and it's simply wrong.
That's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. And you leaving Congress is definitely going to leave a black hole there, because there are not very many people like you, Congressman Baird, Dr. Baird. You're a great man, and I appreciate the time you spent with us today. And I know you're going to have a great time with your family out there in the mountains and your 2 boys.
Well, we'll keep this fight up, but I want to encourage your listeners, members of Congress just have to hear more from people who, you know, just the story I've just said, members of Congress have to hear from multiple sides on this issue. If they only hear from one side, they will continue to only act on that one side and not even know there's another reality out there.
Right.
Programs like yours and your listeners have a real important voice.
We have to let them know that they need to contact their representatives. Well, they could start by going to your website, really, I mean, because they can get a wealth of information there.
They sure can.
They could just go to house.gov. And you're pretty much right at the top because of your name. It's alphabetical, right?
If you just do any search engine and say Congressman Brian Baird, it'll probably take you to something fairly quickly, although you never know how the vicissitudes of search engine.
But it is house.gov.
Yeah, house.gov.
You're right.
Baird, house.gov.
And all of your videos are there. Congressman Baird, Dr. Baird, thanks so much for your time, sir. And,
My privilege. Thank you.
Enjoy your family so much.
I will. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
You too.